explain. I wrote you, but...
Why? Said Aunt Agatha. Lord damn me if it isn't Ross. Come here, boy. I thought you was gone to make one of the blessed above.
Reluctantly, Ross walked down the table to greet his great aunt. Elizabeth stayed where she was, holding the back of her chair so that her knuckles were whiter even than her face. Ross kissed Aunt Agatha's whiskery cheek. Into her ear he said, I'm glad to see, Aunt, that you're still one of the blessed below. She chuckled with delight, showing her pale brownish-pink gums.
Not so blessed, maybe, but I wouldn't want to be changing just yet.
The conversation became general, everyone questioning Ross as to when he had landed, what he had done and seen while away.
Elizabeth, said Mrs. Chenoweth, fetch me my wrap from upstairs, will you? I'm a little chilly.
Yes, Mother.
She turned and walked away, tall and virginal, groped with her hand for the oak banister.
That fellow painter is a rogue, said Charles,
wiping his hands down the sides of his breeches.
If I was you, I should throw him out and get a reliable man.
Ross was watching Elizabeth go up the stairs. He was my father's friend. Charles shrugged in some annoyance.
You won't find the house in a good state of repair.
It wasn't when I left.
Well, it's worse now. I haven't been over for some time. You know what your father used to say about coming in the other direction? It's too far to walk and not far enough to ride.
Eat this, Ross, said Verity, bringing a piled plate to him. And sit here. Ross thanked her and took the seat offered him between Aunt Agatha and Mr. Chenoweth. He would have preferred to be beside Elizabeth, but that would have to wait. He was surprised to find Elizabeth here. She and her mother and father had never once been to Nampara in the 2 years he'd known her. Two or three times he glanced up as he ate to see if she was returning. Verity was helping Mrs. Tabb to carry out some of the used dishes. Francis stood plucking at his lip by the front door. The others were back in their chairs. The silence had fallen on the company.
"It is no easy countryside to which you return," said Mr. Chenoweth, pulling at his beard. "Discontent is rife. Taxes are high. Wages have fallen. The country is exhausted from its many wars, and now the Whigs are in. I can think of no worse a prospect."
"Had the Whigs been in before," said Dr. Choke,
refusing to be tactful,
"none of this need have happened."
Ross looked across at Francis. "I've interrupted a party. Is it a celebration of the peace, or in honour of the next war?" Thus he forced the explanation they had hesitated to give.
"No," said Francis. The position is..."
"We are celebrating something far different," said Charles,
motioning for his glass to be filled again.
"Francis is to be married. That is what we are celebrating."
"To be married?" said Ross, slicing his food. "Well, well. And who?"
"To Elizabeth," said Mrs. Chenoweth.
There was silence. Ross put down his knife.
To my daughter."
"Can I get you something to drink?"
Verity whispered to Elizabeth, who had just reached the bottom of the stairs.
"No, no. Please, no."
"Oh," said Ross. "To... Elizabeth."
"We are very happy," said Mrs. Chenoweth, "that our two ancient families are to be united, very happy and very proud. I am sure, Ross, that you will join with us in wishing Francis and Elizabeth all happiness in their union."
Walking very carefully, Elizabeth came over to Mrs. Chenoweth.
You're right, Mama.
Thank you, dear.
Ross went on with his meal.
I don't know what your opinion is, said Charles heartily after a pause. But for myself, I am attached to this port. It was run over from Cherbourg in the autumn of 79. When I tasted a sample, I said to myself, it is too good to be repeated. I'll buy the lot. Nor has it been repeated, nor has it.
He put down his hands to ease his great paunch against the table.
I suppose you'll be settling down now, Ross, eh?
Said Aunt Agatha, a wrinkled hand on his sleeve.
How about a little wife for you, eh? That's what we've to find next.
Ross looked across at Dr. Choke. You attended my father? Dr. Choke nodded. Did he suffer much?
At the end, but the time was short.
It was strange that he should fail so quickly.
Nothing could be done. It was a dropsical condition that was beyond the power of man to allay.
I rode over, said Cousin William Alfred, to see him twice. But I regret that he was not, in the mood to make the most of such spiritual comfort as I could offer. It was to me a personal sorrow that I could be of so little help to one of my own blood.
You must have some of this apple tart, Ross, said Verity, in an undertone behind him, glancing at the veins in his neck.
I made it myself this afternoon.
I mustn't stop. I called here only for a few minutes and to rest my horse, which is lame.
Oh, but there's no need to go tonight. I have told Mrs. Tabb to prepare a room. Your horse may stumble in the dark and throw you.
Ross looked up at Verity and smiled. In this company, no private word could pass between them. Now Francis, and to a lesser degree his father, joined in the argument. But Francis was constrained, his father half-hearted, and Ross determined. Charles said,
Well, have it as you wish, boy. I would not fancy arriving at Nampara tonight. It will be cold and wet and perhaps no welcome. Pour some more spirit into you to keep out the chill.
Ross did as he was urged, drinking three glasses in succession. With the fourth, he got to his feet.
To Elizabeth,
he said slowly.
And to Francis. May they find happiness together.
The toast was drunk more quietly than the others. Elizabeth was still standing behind her mother's chair. Francis had at last moved from the door to put a hand beneath her arm. In the silence which followed, Mrs. Choke said,
How nice it must be to be home again. I never go away, even a little way, without feeling that gratified to be back. What are the American colonies like, Captain Poldark? They say as how even the sun does not rise and set in the same way in foreign parts.
Polly Choke's inanity seemed to relieve the tension, and talk broke out again while Ross finished his meal. There was more than one there conscious of relief that he had taken the news so quietly. Ross, however, was not staying, and presently took his leave.
"You'll come over in a day or two, will you not?"
said Francis, a rush of affection in his voice.
"We've heard nothing so far, nothing but the barest details of your experiences, or how you were wounded, or of your journey home. Elizabeth will be returning home tomorrow. We plan to be married in a month." If you want my help at Nampara, send a message over. You know I shall be pleased to come. Why, it's like old time seeing you back again. We feared for your life, did we not, Elizabeth?
Yes, said Elizabeth. Ross picked up his hat. They were standing together at the door, waiting for Tab to bring round Ross's mare. He had refused the loan of a fresh horse for the last 3 miles.
"He'll be here now. That's if he can handle her. I warned him to be careful."
Francis opened the door. The wind blew in a few spots of rain. He went out, tactfully, to see if Tab had come. Ross said, "I hope my mistimed resurrection hasn't cast a cloud over your evening." The light from indoors threw a shaft across her face, showed up the grey eyes. The shadows had spread to her face, and she looked ill.
"I'm so happy that you're back, Ross. I had feared. We had all feared. What can you think of me?"
2 years is a long time, isn't it? Too long, perhaps.
"Elizabeth," said Mrs. Chenoweth, "take care the night air does not catch you." "No, Mama."
"Goodbye." He took her hand. Francis came back.
"He's here now. Did you buy the mare? She's a handsome creature, but very ill-tempered."
"Ill usage makes the sweetest of us vicious," said Ross. "Has the rain stopped?"
"Not quite. You know your way."
Ross showed his teeth. "Every stone. Has it changed?"
"Nothing to mislead you. Do not cross the Melingee by the bridge. The middle plank is rotten."
"So it was when I left."
"Do not forget," said Francis. "We expect you back here soon. Verity will want to see more of you. If she can spare the time, we will ride over tomorrow."
But only the wind and the rain answered him, and the clatter of hooves as the mare sidestepped resentfully down the drive. Darkness had fallen by now, though a patch of fading light glimmered in the west. The wind blew more strongly, and the soft rain beat in flurries about his head. His was not an easy face to read, and you couldn't have told that in the last half hour he had suffered the worst knock of his life. Except that he no longer whistled into the wind or talked to his irritable mare. There was nothing to show. At an early age, he had caught from his father a view of things which took very little for granted. But in his dealings with Elizabeth Chenoweth, he had fallen into the sort of trap such an outlook might have helped him to avoid. They had been in love since she was 16, and he barely 20. When his own high-spirited misadventures caught up with him, he had thought his father's solution of a commission in the army a good idea while the trouble blew over. He had gone away eager for fresh experience, and sure of the one circumstance of his return which would really matter. No doubt was in his own mind, and he had looked for none in hers. After he had been riding for a time, the lights of Grambler Mine showed up ahead. This was the mine round which the varying fortunes of the main Poldark family centred. On its vagaries depended not merely the prosperity of Charles Poldark and his family, but the subsistence level of some 300 miners and their families, scattered in huts and cottages about the parish. To them, the mine was a benevolent Moloch, to whom they fed their children at an early age, and from whom they took their daily bread. He saw swinging lights approaching, and drew into the side of the track to let a mule train pass, with the panniers of copper ore slung on either side of the animals' backs. One of the men in charge peered up at him suspiciously, then shouted a greeting. It was Mark Daniel. The main buildings of the mine were all about him now, most of them huddled together and indeterminate, but here and there the sturdy scaffolding of headgear and the big stone-built engine houses stood out. Yellow lights showed in the arched upper windows of the engine houses, warm and mysterious against the low night sky. He passed close beside one of them and heard the rattle and clang of the great draft bob pumping water up from the lowest places of the earth. There were miners in groups and a number of lanterns. Several men peered up at the figure on the horse. But although several said good night, he thought that none of these recognized him. Then a bell rang in one of the engine houses, a not unmellow note. It was the time for changing cores. That was why there were so many men about. They were assembling to go down. Other men now would be on their way up, climbing, ant-like, 100 fathoms of rickety ladders, sweat-covered and stained with rusty markings of the mineral rock or the black fumes of blasting powder. It would take them half an hour or more to come to the surface carrying their tools, and all the way they would be splashed and drenched with water from the leaky pumps. On reaching grass, many would have a 3 or 4 mile walk through the wind and rain. He moved on. Now and then the feeling within him was so strong that he could have been physically sick. The Melinji was forded, and horse and rider began wearily to climb the narrow track towards the last clump of fir trees. Ross took a deep breath of the air, which was heavy with rain and impregnated with the smell of the sea. He fancied he could hear the waves breaking. At the top of the rise, the mare, all her ill nature gone, stumbled again and almost fell. So Ross awkwardly got down and began to walk. At first, he could hardly put his foot to the ground. But he welcomed this pain in his ankle, which occupied thoughts that would have been elsewhere. In the coppice, it was pitch black, and he had to feel his way along a path which had become part overgrown. At the other side, the ruined buildings of Wheel Maiden greeted him, a mine which had been played out for 40 years. As a boy, he had fought and scrambled about the derelict Windlass and the Horsewhim, had explored the shallow adit that ran through the hill and came out near the stream. Now he felt he was really home. In a moment, he would be on his own land. This afternoon he had been filled with pleasure at the prospect, but now nothing seemed to matter. He could only be glad that his journey was done, and that he might lie down and rest. In the cup of the valley, the air was still. The trickle and bubble of Melinji stream had been lost. But now it came to his ears again, like the mutterings of a thin old woman. An owl hooted and swung silently before his face in the dark. Water dripped from the rim of his hat. There ahead, in the soft and sighing darkness, was the solid line of Nampara House. It struck him as smaller than he remembered, lower and more squat. It straggled like a row of workmen's cottages. There was no light to be seen. At the lilac tree, now grown so big as to overshadow the windows behind it, he tethered the mare and rapped with his riding whip on the front door. There had been heavy rain here. Water was trickling from the roof in several places and forming pools on the sandy overgrown path. He thrust open the door. It went creaking back, pushing a heap of refuse before it. And he peered into the low, irregularly beamed hall. Only the darkness greeted him. An intenser darkness, which made the night seem grey.
"Judd!"
he called.
"Judd!"
The mare outside whinnied and stamped. Something scuttled beside the wainscot. Then he saw eyes. They were lambent, green-gold, stared at him unwinkingly from the back of the hall. He limped into the house, feeling leaves and dirt underfoot. He fingered his way round the panels to the right until he came to the door leading into the parlour. He lifted the latch and went in. At once, there was a scuffling and rustling, and the sound of animals disturbed. His foot slid on something slimy on the floor, and in putting out his hand, he knocked over a candlestick. He retrieved it, set the candle back in its socket, groped for his flint and steel. After two or three attempts, the spark caught, and he lit the candle. This was the largest room in the house. It was half-panelled with dark mahogany, and in the far corner was a great broad fireplace, half the width of the room, recessed and built round with low settles. This was the room the family had always lived in, large enough and airy enough for the rowdiest company on the hottest days, yet with warm corners and cosy furniture to cheat the draughts of winter. But all that was changed. The fireplace was empty, and hens roosted on the settles. The floor was filthy with old straw and droppings. From the bracket of a candle sconce, a cockerel viewed him with a liverish eye. On one of the window seats were two dead chickens. Opening out of the hall on the left was Joshua's bedroom, and he next tried this. Signs of life. Clothing which had never belonged to his father. Filthy old petticoats. A battered three-cornered hat. A jar without stopper from which he sniffed gin. But the box bed was closed, and the three captive thrushes in a cage before the shuttered window could tell him nothing of the couple he looked for. At the farther end of the room was another door leading into that part of the house which had never been finished. But he did not go in. The place to look was in the bedroom upstairs at the back of the house, where Judd and Prudy always slept. He turned back to the door, and there stopped and listened. A peculiar sound had come to his ears. The fowls had settled down, and silence, like a parted curtain, was falling back upon the house. He thought he heard a creak on the shallow stairs, but when he peered out with the candle held high, he could see nothing. This was not the sound he was listening for, nor the movement of rats, nor the faint hissing of the stream outside, nor the crackle of charred paper under his boot. He looked up at the ceiling, but the beams and floorboards were sound. Something rubbed itself against his leg. It was the cat, whose bright eyes he had seen earlier. His father's kitten, Tabitha Bethia. But grown into a big, grey animal, and leprously patched with mange. She seemed to recognise him, and he put down his hand gratefully to her inquiring whiskers. Then the sound came again, and this time he caught its direction. He strode over to the box bed and slid back the doors. A powerful smell of stale sweat and gin. He thrust in the candle. Dead drunk and locked in each other's arms were Judd and Prudy Painter. The woman was in a long flannel nightgown. Her mouth was open and her varicosed legs asprawl. Judd had not succeeded in getting properly undressed, but snored by her side in his breeches and leggings. Ross stared at them for some moments. Then he withdrew and put the candlestick on the great low chest near the bed. He walked out of the room and made his way round to the stables at the east end of the house. Here he found a wooden pail and took it to the pump. This he filled, carried it round the house, through the hall and into the bedroom. He tipped the water into the bed. He went out again. A few stars were showing in the west, but the wind was freshening. In the stables, he noted, there were only two half-starved horses. Ramoth. Yes, one was still Ramoth. The horse had been 12 years old and half blind from cataract when he left. He carried the second bucket round, through the hall, across the bedroom, and tipped it into the bed. The mare whinnied at his second passing. She preferred even his company to the darkness and unfamiliarity of the garden. When he brought the third bucket, Judd was groaning and muttering, and his bald head was in the opening of the box door. Ross allowed him this bucket to himself. By the time he returned with the fourth, the man had climbed out of bed and was trying to shake the streaming water from his clothing. Prudy was only just stirring, so Ross devoted the water to her. Judd began to curse and grope for his jackknife. Ross hit him on the side of the head and knocked him down. Then he went for another supply. At his fifth appearance, there was more intelligence in the eyes of the servant, though he was still on the ground. At sight of him, Judd began to curse and sweat and threaten. But after a moment, a look of puzzlement crept across his face.
"Dear life, is it you, Mr. Ross?"
"From the grave," said Ross. "And there's a horse to be seen to. Up, before I kill you." By the collar of his shirt, he lifted the man to his feet and thrust him forward towards the door. Chapter 3. A wet October evening is depressing, but it drapes some soft shadows on the rough edges of ruin and decay. Not so the light of morning. Even at the height of his mining, Joshua had always had a few fields under care. The house had been clean and homely, well furnished and well stocked considering the district. After a tour which lasted from 8 until 10, Ross called the painters out of the house and stood with legs apart looking at them. They shuffled and were uneasy under his gaze. Judd was 4 inches the shorter of the two. He was a man in his early 50s, to whom bow legs gave a look of horsiness and bulldog strength. During the last 10 years, satirical nature had tonsured his head like a friar. He had lived in this district all his life, first as a tributer at Grambler Mine, then at Wheel Grace, where Joshua took to him in spite of his weaknesses. Prudy, Judd had picked up at Bedruthen 10 years ago. Their first meeting was one of the things that Judd held his tongue about even in his cups. They had never married, but she had taken his name as a matter of course. She was now 40, 6 feet in height, with lank Spanish hair, incurably lousy, and wide-shouldered, with a powerful body which bulged everywhere it aesthetically shouldn't. "You're tired after a hard morning's work," said Ross. Judd looked at him uneasily from under hairless brows. With Joshua, he had always had to mind his P's and Q's, but of Ross, he had never been at all afraid. A harum-scarum, highly strung, lanky youngster. There was nothing in him to fear. But 2 years of soldiering had changed the boy.
"'Taz as clean as a new scrub place can be,' said Judd, on a grudging note. "'We've been at 'en for 2 hours solid. Splinters I got in me hand from the old floor, Dratton. Blood poisoned I shall be, maybe. Runs from your hand to your arm, it do. Up your veins, and then, you're dead.'
Ross turned his sleepy but unquiet eyes on Prudy. "'Your wife has not suffered from her wetting. "'As well not to forget the feel and taste of water. "'Very little is used in jail.' "'Judd looked up sharply.
"'Who says jail? "'Prudy ain't going to jail. "'What's she done?'
"'No more than you have. "'A pity you can't share the same cell.' "'Prudy sniggered.
"'You will have your jest.'
"'The jest,' said Ross, "'was yours last night, and for 50 nights before.'
"'You can't get neither of us convicted for being a bit tiddly,' said Judd. tedn't law, tedn't right, tedn't just, tedn't sense, tedn't friendly. Leave alone all we've done for you.
You were my father's personal servant. When he died, you were left in a position of trust. Well, you may have a guinea for every field you find that isn't choked with weed and lying fallow. The same for a barn or a stable that is not falling down for need of a timely repair. Even the apples in the orchard are mouldering amongst the dead leaves for lack of someone to gather them.
'Twere a poor summer for fruit. Down come the apples, rotten away with wasps in 'em. Shocking 'twas. You can't do nothing to an apple when there's a drain in it. Not except kill the drain and eat the apple. And there's a limit to what two bodies can eat.
'Twas a nice chance that I didn't swaller one of they wasps, said Prudy. There was I munching away, as clever as you like. Then sharp, just as I has me teeth in un, I hears a vzz, vzz. And my ivers, there he is. You can't see the front end, but the back end is there waving about like a lamb's tail. All his legs are going and striped like a flag. If I hadn't just heard.
Get one of they in your ozzle, said Judd gloomily. Out come their sting and fit, you're dead.
Lazy in everything, said Ross, but the search for excuses. Like two old pigs in their sty, and as slow to move from their own patch of filth. Prudy picked up her apron and began to dab her nose. Ross warmed to his theme. He had learned abuse from a master and had added to it while away. Also, he knew his listeners. I suspect it must be easy to convert good stock into cheap gin, he ended. Men have been hanged for less.
We thought 'twas rumoured.
Judd sucked his gums in hesitation.
Folks said.
That I was dead? Who said it?
'Twas common belief,
Prudy said somberly. Yet I find it only near my own home. Did you begin the story?
No, no, tedn't true. Not by no means. 'Tis we you should thank for giving the lie to such a story. Nail it, I says. Nail it to the bud, I says. I've got the firmest faith, I says, and Prudy can bear me forth. Did we believe such a wicked lie, Prudy? Dear life, no, said Prudy.
My uncle has always thought you wastrels and parasites. I think I can arrange for your case to come before him. They stood there on shifty feet, half resentful, half alarmed. He had no understanding of their difficulties, and they had no words to explain. Any guilt they might have felt was long since overgrown by these explanations which they could not frame. Their feeling now was one of outrage at being so harshly attacked. Everything had been done, or left undone, for a very good reason.
We've only four pairs of hands, said Judd.
Ross's sense of humour was not working, or he might have been undone by this remark. There is much jail fever this year, he said. A lack of cheap gin will not be your only hardship. He turned and left them to their fears. In the gloom of the Red Lion stables, he had thought his hired mare had a damaged fetlock. But the light of day showed the lameness to be no more than the result of a very bad shoeing. The mare had an open flat foot, and the shoe was fitted too short and too close. He rode into Truro next day on the almost blind Remoth to see if he could do business with the landlord of the Red Lion. The landlord was a little doubtful whether enough time had passed to give him the right to dispose of his surety. But legality was never Ross's strong point, and he had his way. While in the town, he drew a bill on Pasco's bank and spent some of his slender capital on 2 young oxen, which he arranged for Judd to collect. If the fields were to be worked at all, there must be an outlay upon working animals. With some smaller things slung over his saddle, he arrived back shortly after 1 and found Verity waiting for him. For a sudden leaping moment, he thought it was Elizabeth.
"You did not come to visit me, cousin," she said, "so I must wait on you. That I have now been doing for 40-odd minutes."
He bent and kissed her cheek.
"You should have sent word. I've been to Truro. Judd will have told you." "Yes. He offered me a garden chair, but I was afraid to sit on it lest it collapse under my weight." "Oh, Ross, your poor house."
He glanced up towards the building. The conservatory was smothered with giant convolvulus, which had swept over it, flowered, and was beginning to rot. "It can be put right."
"I'm ashamed," she said, "that we have not been over, that I have not been over more often, these painters."
"You've been busy."
"Oh, we have. Only now that the crops are in have we time to look round. But that's no excuse."
He glanced down at her as she stood beside him. She, at least, had not changed, with her trim little figure and untidy hair and big, generous mouth. She had walked over from Tremwith, in her working dress, with no hat, and her dove-grey cloak pulled carelessly about her shoulders. They began to walk round to the stables. "I have just bought a mare," he said. "You must see her. Old Squire is beyond recall, and Big Ramoth has not eyes to avoid the stones and ruts."
"Tell me about your wound," she said. "Does it pain you much now? When was it done?"
"Oh, long ago, at the James River. It is nothing." She glanced at him.
"You were always one to hide your hurt, were you not?"
"This is the mare," he said.
"I have just paid 25 guineas for her. A great bargain, don't you think?"
She hesitated.
"Does she not limp too? Francis was saying. And that right leg, which he holds,
will get better more quickly than mine. I wish you could heal any injury by a change of shoes."
"What's her name?"
"No one knows. I'm waiting for you to christen her." Verity pushed back her hair and frowned with one eyebrow.
I should call her Darkie."
"For any reason?"
"She has that pretty black streak. And also, it's a tribute to her new owner."
He laughed and began to unsaddle Ramoth and rub him down, while his cousin leaned against the stable door and chattered. Her father often complained that she was lacking in the graces, meaning that she was incapable of the flowery but agreeable small talk which added so much to the savour of life. But with Ross, she was never tongue-tied. He asked her to dinner, but she refused.
"I must go soon. I have far more to see to now that father is not so nimble."
"And enjoy it, I suppose. Walk with me as far as the sea first. It may be days before you come again." She did not argue, for it was pleasant to her to have her company sought. They set off linking, as they had done as children. But this way his lameness was too noticeable, and he loosed her arm and put his long bony hand on her shoulder. The nearest way of reaching the sea from the house was to climb a stone wall and drop down upon Hendrawna Beach. But today they climbed the long field behind the house and walked the way Joshua had walked in his dream.
"My dear, you'd have some hard work to get things shaped up," Verity said, looking about her. "You must have help."
"There is all winter to spend." She tried to read his expression.
"You're not thinking of going away again, Ross?"
very quickly if I had money, or were not lame, but the two together.
Shall you keep Judd and Prudy?
They have agreed to work without wages. I shall keep them until some of the gin is sweated out of them. And, also this morning, I've taken a boy named Carter, who called asking for work. Do you know him?
Carter? One of Connie Carter's children, from Grambler?
I think so. He has been at Grambler, but the underground work was too heavy. There's not enough air in the 60-fathom level to clear the blasting powder, and he says he started coughing black phlegm in the mornings. So he has to have outdoor work.
Oh, that will be Jim, her eldest. His father died young.
Well, I can't afford to pay invalids, but he seems an acceptable boy. He's starting tomorrow at 6. They reached the edge of the cliff, where they were 70 or 80 feet above the sea. On the left, the cliff slipped down to the inlet of Nampara Cove, then rose again more steeply towards Saul. Looking east upon Hendrawna Beach, the sea was very calm today. A smoky grey, with here and there patches of violet and living, moving green. The waves were shadows, snakes under a quilt, creeping in almost unseen until they emerge in milky ripples at the water's edge. The gentle sea breeze moved against his face, barely touching his hair. The tide was going out. As they looked, the green of the sea quickened and stirred under the crouching clouds. He had not slept well last night. Seen from this side with the pale blue-grey eyes half-lidded and the scar showing white on the brown cheek, his whole face had a strange disquiet. Verity looked away and abruptly said,
"You would be surprised to learn about Francis and Elizabeth."
I had no option on the girl.
"It was strange," she went on, haltingly, "the way it happened. Francis had scarcely seen her until this summer passed. They met at the Pascoe's. Then he could talk of nothing else. Naturally, I told him you had been friendly with her. But she had already told him that.
Kind of her.
Ross, I'm certain sure that neither of them wished to do anything unfair. It was just one of the things that happen. You do not argue with the clouds or the rain or the lightning. Well, this was like that. It came from outside them. I know Francis, and he couldn't help himself."
"How prices have risen since I went away," said Ross. "I paid 3 and 3 a yard for Holland linen today. All my shirts have been eaten by the moths."
"And then," said Verity, "there was the rumour of your having been killed. I do not know how it came about, but I think it was the painters who stood most to gain."
"Not more than Francis."
"No," said Verity. "But it was not he."
Ross kept his tortured eyes on the sea. "That was not a pretty thought," he said after a moment. She pressed his arm.
"I wish I could help you, my dear. Will you not come over often? Why do you not have dinner with us every day? My cooking is better than Prudy's."
He shook his head. "I must find my own way out of this." "When are they to be married?"
"November the 1st.
"So soon? I thought it was to be more than a month."
"They decided last night."
"Oh, I see."
"It is to be at Trenwith, for that suits us all best. Cusgarn is nearly falling down and full of draughts and leaks. Elizabeth and her mother and father are coming in their carriage in the morning."
She chattered on, aware that Ross was hardly attending, but anxious to help him over this difficult period. Presently she was silent and followed his example in staring out to sea.
"If," she said, If I were sure not to get in your way this winter, I would come over when I could, if...
That, he said, would help more than anything. They began to walk back towards the house. He did not see how red she had gone, flushing up to the roots of her hair. So it was to be November the 1st, less than a fortnight forward. He went a little way with his cousin, and when they parted he stood at the edge of the pine copse and saw her walking quickly and sturdily in the direction of Grambler. The smoke and steam from the mine was drifting in a cloud across the desolate, rubble-scarred moorland towards Tremwith. Beyond the rising ground which made up the southeastern rib of Nampara Coombe was a hollow in which lay a cluster of cottages known as Melin. It was Poldark land, and in these six cottages, built in the form of a friendly right angle, so that everyone could the more easily watch everyone else's comings and goings, lived the Triggses, the Clemos, the Martins, the Daniels, and the Viguses. Here, Ross went in search of cheap labour. The Poldarks had always been on good terms with their tenants. Distinction of class was not absent. It was understood so clearly that nobody needed to emphasise it. But in districts where life centred round the nearest mine, polite convention was not allowed to stand in the way of common sense. The small landowners, with their long pedigrees and short purses, were accepted as a part of the land they owned. On his way to the Martins, Ross had to pass three of the cottages, before the door of the first, of which Joe Triggs sat sunning himself and smoking. Triggs was a miner in the mid-50s, crippled with rheumatism, and supported by his aunt, who made a bare living fish-jousting in Saul. It did not seem that he had moved since Ross went away 28 months ago. England had lost an empire in the west. She had secured her grip upon an empire in the east. She had fought single-handed against the Americans, the French, the Dutch, the Spaniards, and Hyder Ali of Mysore. Governments, fleets and nations had grappled, had risen and been overthrown. Balloons had ascended in France. The Royal George had turned on her beam-ends at Spithead, and Chatham's son had taken his first cabinet office. But for Joe Triggs, nothing had changed, except that this knee or that shoulder was more or less painful. Each day was so like the last that they merged into an unchanging pattern and slipped away unremarked. While talking to the old man, Ross's eyes were straying over the rest of the cottages. The one next to this had been empty since the whole family had died of smallpox in 79, and it had now lost part of its roof. The one beyond, the Clemos, looked little better. What could one expect? Eli, the younger and brighter, had gone off to some lackey's job in Truro, leaving only Reuben. The three cottages of the opposite angle were all in good repair. The Martins and the Daniels were his particular friends. And Nick Vigus looked after his cottage, for all that he was a slippery rogue. At the Martin cottage, Mrs. Zaki Martin, flat-faced and bespectacled and cheerful, showed him into the single dark room downstairs, with its floor of well-trodden earth, on which three naked babies rolled and crowed. There were two new faces since Ross left, making 11 in all. And Mrs. Martin was pregnant again. Four boys were already underground at Grambler, and the eldest daughter, Ginny, was a spooler at the mine. The three next youngest children, aged 5 and upwards, were just the sort of cheap labour Ross needed for clearing his fields. This sunny morning, with the sights and sounds and smells of his own land about him, the war of which he had been a part seemed unsubstantial and far off. He wondered if the real world was that one in which men fought for policies and principles and died or lived gloriously, or more often miserably. for the sake of an abstract word like patriotism or independence, or if reality belonged to the humble people and the common land. It seemed that nothing would stop Mrs. Zaki talking. But just then, her daughter Ginny came back from her shift at the mine. She seemed out of breath, and about to say something when she pushed open the half-door of the cottage. But on seeing Ross, she came forward and curtsied awkwardly, and was tongue-tied.
"My eldest," said Mrs. Zaki, folding her arms across her wide bosom. 17 a month gone. What's to do, child? Have ye forgotten Mr. Ross?" "No, mother. No, sir. Tedn't that at all."
She went to the wall, untied her apron, and pulled off her big linen bonnet. "She's a fine girl," said Ross, inspecting her absently. "You should be proud of her." Ginny blushed. Mrs. Zaki was staring at her daughter.
"Is it that Reuben that's been playing you up again?"
A shadow fell across the door, and Ross saw the tall figure of Reuben Clemo striding towards his cottage. He still wore his damp blue miner's drill coat and trousers, the old hard hat with its candle stuck to the front by clay, and he carried 4 excavating tools, one of them a heavy iron jumper used for boring.
"He follow me every day,"
said the girl, with tears of annoyance in her eyes.
"Bothering me to walk with him. And when I walk, he says nothing but only looks. Why don't he leave me alone?" "There now, don't take on so," said her mother. "Go tell they 3 young imps to come in if they'd want anything to eat."
Ross saw his opportunity to leave, and got up as the girl ran from the hut and called out in a shrill, clear voice to 3 of the Martin children who were working in a potato patch.
"'Tas a prime worry to we," said Mrs. Martin. "He do follow her everywhere. Zaki's warned him 2.
"He keeps his cottage in an uncommon bad state. You must find the stench very poor when the wind is that way."
"Oh, we don't creen nothing about that. It is the maid we are concerned for."
Ross could see Reuben Clemo standing at his cottage door, watching Ginny, following her with his small pale eyes and his disconcerting stare. The Clemos had always been a trouble to the neighbourhood. Father and Mother Clemo had been dead some years. Father Clemo had been a deaf mute and had fits. Children had made fun of him because of his twisted mouth and the gobbling noises he made. Mother Clemo had been all right to look at, but there had been something rotten about her. She was not a woman content with the ordinary human sins of copulation and drunkenness. He remembered seeing her publicly whipped in Truro Market for selling poisonous abortion powders. The 2 Clemos had been in and out of trouble for years, but Eli had always seemed the more difficult. "Has he given trouble while I've been away?"
"Reuben? Nah. Except that he scat in Nick Vigus's head one day last winter when he was tormenting him. But we hold no blame to him for that, for I could do it myself oftentimes."
He thought, by returning to the simple life of the peasant, one did not escape. In his case, he exchanged the care of his company of infantry for this implicit concern for the welfare of people living on his land. He might not be a squire in the fullest sense, but the responsibilities did not deter him. "Do you think he means harm to Ginny?"
"That we can't tell," said Mrs. Zaki. "If he was to do anything, he'd never get into no court of law. But 'tes worrying for a mother, my dear, as you'll acknowledge."
Reuben Clemo saw that he, in his turn, was being watched. He stared blankly at the 2 people in the doorway of the other cottage. Then he turned and entered his own cottage, slamming the doors behind him. Ginny and the 3 children were returning. Ross looked at the girl with more interest. Neat and trim she was, a pretty little thing, those good brown eyes, the pale skin slightly freckled across the nose, the thick auburn hair. There would be plenty of admirers among the young men of the district. Little wonder that she had turned up her nose at Reuben, who was nearly 40 and weak in the head. "If Reuben gives further trouble," Ross said, "send up a message to me and I'll come and talk to him."
"Thank ye, sir. We'd be in your debt. Maybe if you spoke to him, he'd take some account of it."
On his way home, Ross passed the engine house of Wheel Grace, that mine from which had come all his father's prosperity, and into which it had all returned. It stood on the hill on the opposite side of the valley from Wheel Maiden, and, known as Trevorgy Mine, had been worked in primitive fashion centuries ago, Joshua having used some of the early working and rechristened the venture after his wife. Ross thought he would look over it, for any concern was better than moping the days away. The next afternoon, he put on a suit of his father's mining clothes and was about to leave the house, followed by mutterings from Prudy about rotten planks and foul air, when he saw a horseman riding down the valley and knew it to be Francis. He was on a fine roan horse and was dressed in a fashionable manner, with buff-coloured breeches, a yellow waistcoat, and a narrow-waisted coat of dark brown velvet with a high collar. He reined up before Ross, and the horse reared at the check.
"Hey, Rufus, quiet boy. Well, well, Ross."
He dismounted, his face smiling and friendly.
"Quiet boy. Well, what's this? Are you on tribute at Grambler?"
"No, I have a mind to examine Grace." Francis raised his eyebrows.
"She was an old strumpet. You don't hope to restart her."
"Even strumpets have their uses. I'm taking a stock of what I own, whether it is worthless or of value." Francis coloured slightly.
"Sensible enough. Perhaps you can wait an hour."
"Come down with me," Ross suggested. "But perhaps you no longer care for such adventure in that attire." Francis's flush became deeper.
"Of course I'll come," he said shortly. "Give me an old suit of your father's."
"There's no need. I'll go another day." Francis handed his horse to Judd, who had just come down from the field.
"We can talk on the way. It will be of interest to me."
They went indoors, and Ross searched among such of his father's belongings as the painters had not sold. When suitable things had been found, Francis stripped off his fine clothes and put them on. They left the house, and to overcome the restraint, Ross forced himself to talk of his experiences in America, where he had been sent as a raw ensign, after only a month with his regiment in Ireland. Of those hectic first 3 months under Lord Cornwallis, when almost all the fighting he had seen had taken place. Of the advance towards Portsmouth, and the sudden attack by the French while they were crossing the James River. Of the routing of Lafayette, of a musket ball in the ankle, and his being drafted to New York as a result. So escaping the siege of Yorktown, of a bayonet cut in the face during a local skirmish while the articles of the preliminary peace were being signed. They reached the mine and the engine house, and Ross poked about among the tall gorse for some minutes. Then he went over to his cousin, who was peering down the shaft.
"How deep did they drive it?"
Francis asked. "No more than 30 fathoms, I believe, and most of that will be under water. But I have heard my father say that most of the old Trevorgy working drained itself."
"We have begun an 80-fathom level at Grambler, and it promises big things. How long since this ladder was used?"
10 years, I suppose. Shelter me, will you?" The strong breeze hindered the lighting of the hempen candles. With one candle in the front of each hard hat, they began to descend the ladder. Francis would have gone first, but Ross stopped him. "Wait, I'll try it out." The first dozen